Hi guys, and welcome to this episode of StudyClicks Explains, where StudyClicks expert teacher Peter Tobin brings you through interesting things to know about the characters Banquo, the Porter, and Macduff, and their roles in Macbeth. Peter Tobin is an English teacher who has a YouTube channel called Mr. Tobin Leaving Cert English, where you can find a whole bunch of free videos covering different parts of the Leaving Cert English course. He also has things like downloadable worksheets and note grids, so it's well worth checking him out and subscribing to his channel to get updates on new content he's making. In this episode, you'll learn about how Banquo, the Porter, and Macduff shaped the story, analysing their impact beyond what you may have initially thought on the first read of Macbeth. This is the kind of critical literacy that will help you gain those high marks. The next voice you're going to hear is Peter's. Enjoy listening.
We're going to look at a few ways we can interpret the character of Banquo. For your essay at Leaving Cert level, you're going to have to show a good understanding of the characters in the play, and a good way to show off your understanding is to give sophisticated interpretations of them. Now, the simplest way to look at the character of Banquo is to see him as a foil for Macbeth. A foil character is one who has contrasting characteristics or behaves in a contrasting way to another character, usually the main one. Banquo is Macbeth's friend and someone who is of equal rank to him. They are perfect parallels. They are both present when the witches deliver their prophecies, and it's often forgotten that Banquo receives a prophecy as well, that although he won't be king, he would get kings. So this means that he will beget kings, or in other words, his descendants would be kings. Despite the fact that both of these men of equal position in the social hierarchy receive prophecies from the Weird Sisters, only Macbeth takes matters into his own hands and embarks on his bloody campaign of violence. Banquo's role as a foil here is perfect. He doesn't succumb to the prophecies in the same way that Macbeth does, because he doesn't have the same hamartia or fatal flaw. He is not ambitious in the same way that Macbeth is. Therefore, Banquo could be the perfect embodiment of Shakespeare's warning of selfish individualism. The character that Banquo is based on, again from Holinshed's Chronicles, reveals some interesting distinctions. In the source material, Banquo was actually a part of the plot to kill the king, along with Macbeth. Shakespeare alters this in his own play to paint Banquo in a better light, possibly because it was believed that King James I was a descendant of Banquo. Remember, Banquo's prophecy was that he would beget kings. Shakespeare's own king, who was the patron of his company, was said to be one of these descendants. With this in mind, Banquo would simply have to be presented in a sympathetic light. Shakespeare goes further in his presentation of Banquo as good through his reaction to the witches. Whereas Macbeth believes in the witches at first sight, and even echoes their language and their metre, his very first words of the play being, "So foul and fair a day I have not seen," Banquo questions their very existence. The witches only speak to Banquo when he insists upon it. Perhaps they recognise in him a resistance to evil that is not present in Macbeth. Similarly, Macbeth requests that the witches stay and speak more to him, but Banquo makes it clear that he neither begs nor fears their favours nor their hate. There are some reservations, however, about how good Banquo really is. At the beginning, he does remind Macbeth that sometimes, to win us to their harm, the instruments of darkness tell us truths. But shortly after the murder, Banquo remarks that Macbeth has it all, but fears that he has played most foully for it. This is like an acknowledgement that Banquo suspects Macbeth. But why does Banquo not sound the alarm? Why does he not raise objections or even refuse to support the king, the new king Macbeth, like Macduff does? A line in Act 2, Scene 1 gives us an idea perhaps why he doesn't object. Macbeth tells Banquo that should he cleave to his consent when the time comes, that it may work out well for him. Banquo's response is very vague, and he simply says that so long as he loses no honour by doing so, then he will. At best, Banquo here is morally ambiguous, and at worst he is conspiring with the person he suspects has killed the king. Another enlightening scene is when Banquo and Fleance are in the castle before the murder of Duncan. Banquo admits to having disturbed sleep while thinking about the witch's prophecies, and he asks Fleance to hold his sword, perhaps hinting that he can't trust himself not to do something evil with it. It should also be remembered that Banquo is silent for 40 lines after he learns of Duncan's death. It's almost as if he's paralysed by Macbeth's actions. The appropriate action would be to show loyalty to the rightful heir, Malcolm, and stand in support of his claim to the throne, but instead he does nothing. Ultimately, however, Banquo's resistance to evil and his goodness are what costs his life. Many critics observe that Macbeth, representing evil, and Banquo, representing good, can't exist together. Only one can survive. Either Macbeth destroys Banquo, or is destroyed by him. When Macbeth agonizes over this decision, he says something very telling about Banquo. He refers to his wisdom that doth guide his valour. He is acknowledging that the thing he fears the most about Banquo is that Banquo is good and wise in his nature. Whether Shakespeare was simply rewriting the history books in order to please King James I, or rewriting his source material to tell an even better story, Banquo is a character that is often misunderstood in terms of his complexity. He is good where Macbeth is evil. He leaves things up to chance where Macbeth takes fate into his own hands. The character of Banquo complements Macbeth insofar as it highlights Macbeth's downfall, but Banquo himself is no angel. His actions and his indecision in the face of treason paint him out to be a more complex character than we might imagine. Perhaps Shakespeare is allowing for the fact that nobody is perfect. No person is all good or all evil. But the conflict within Macbeth that leads him to evil deeds appears to have the opposite result in Banquo. This is yet more evidence of Shakespeare's fascination with complex characters, with contrasts and with opposites.
That wraps up Peter's analysis on Banquo. Next, he's going to talk about the porter.
We're going to look at a character who's actually not really a character at all. It's the porter. He only appears once in the whole play, and it's rarely covered in that much detail when students are studying it. Remember though, in order to achieve the highest marks, it's really important to be able to give sophisticated interpretations of the play and its characters, and being able to discuss the porter will really make your essay stand out. Act 2, Scene 3, also known as the porter scene, is a curious one in Macbeth. Some scholars and critics have dismissed it as almost un-Shakespearean and therefore irrelevant. Others have identified the scene as simple comic relief after the murder of King Duncan in the previous scene, a contrast between the horrors carried out by Macbeth and the rude humour of the porter. The most common consensus, however, is that this scene and the porter himself is vitally important to the rest of the play and does much more than just get a few laughs from the audience. In summary, the porter is a servant of the Macbeth household whose job it is to answer the gate to callers. The porter has been up late and joined the celebrations with King Duncan and the other guests, and so he is tired, but also hungover, having drank too much. When he hears the knocking, that of Macduff, who has come to wake the king, he imagines that the knocking is that at the gates of hell, and he is the porter for hell's gate. He imagines himself admitting three different sinners into hell. The first is a farmer who tried to make money by hoarding his grain in the hope that price would rise, but when the price drops, he realizes he's financially ruined and hangs himself. The second is an equivocator. There's a link here with the witches and their equivocation. And he's committed treason, but tries to get himself out of it by telling half-truths. The third is an English tailor, who has been condemned for stealing by making clothes with less material than he charges. All three of these sinners are condemned to death, and the porter imagines welcoming them to hell. In defense of those who argue that the scene is all about providing comic relief after the intensity of Duncan's murder, the humor comes from the fact that these were all topical events at the time that Macbeth would have been first performed. The farmer who hangs himself on the expectation of plenty would have been despised by many as someone looking to profit on the regular food shortages of Shakespeare's time. Interestingly, Shakespeare himself was actually fined for hoarding grain in times of shortages too, while waiting for the best price. The equivocator is widely believed to be Father Garnet, a Jesuit priest who was hanged for his role in the Gunpowder Plot, the Catholic plot to kill James I shortly before Macbeth was written. Finally, the English tailor and the French hose refers to the changing fashions of the time when French hose became so tight-fitting that any skimping of material would have been noticed immediately. Therefore, the English tailor, who has been cheating his customers for years, finally gets it found out when the fashion changes. The audience would have understood these references and are certain to have generated some laughs, especially when they are taken with the porter's later conversation with Macduff about drinking and sexual performance. But we can also look at the function of the porter and his scene in three other ways. Firstly, Shakespeare could be normalising Macbeth's crimes in the previous scene. By putting his actions alongside ordinary crimes, such as stealing and greed and lying, Macbeth's actions don't seem big in scale, they seem cowardly and low. Murdering an old man as he slept in his bed. Macbeth has become no different to an ordinary low criminal through his actions. It serves the function of lowering the standard against which Macbeth's crimes are to be judged. As the famous critic John B. Harcourt puts it, this process continues the association of Macbeth with a petty speculator, with a known traitor, and with a tailor. Macbeth's murder, then, is an ugly deed when put alongside these smaller crimes. So perhaps by listing these smaller crimes that condemn their culprits to hell immediately after the murder of Duncan, Shakespeare is trying to emphasise that Macbeth's actions are not otherworldly or noble or outside of the realm of consequence. They are lowly and common and ugly. But alternatively, Shakespeare could also be emphasising the monstrous nature of Macbeth and how he is, in fact, closer to real evil than these other criminals. The second of these three ways involves the conversation between Macduff and the porter at the beginning of the scene. The porter speaks to Macduff about alcohol and what it does to a man. He talks at length about sexual performance, how alcohol encourages a man to want sex but stops him from being able to perform. In Act 2, Scene 3, he says, "It sets him on and it takes him off. It persuades him and disheartens him, makes him stand to and not stand to. In conclusion, equivocates him." It's clear that, for the porter, alcohol and sexual desire are vices that he battles with. He refers to being under the influence of alcohol almost like demonic possession. There is no question that Macbeth does not share these vices. There are no references to Macbeth indulging in alcohol or women. Shakespeare here could be suggesting that the simple vices of the porter, alcohol and women, are not as bad as Macbeth's vices: greed, self-seeking ambition and pride. Macduff himself, when he meets Malcolm, echoes this when he suggests that Malcolm's vices wouldn't prevent him from being king until he says that he wants to destroy peace. According to Harcourt again, the simple vices of the porter establish an ethical distance between the failings of ordinary humanity and monstrous evil now within the castle walls. The third way of examining this scene is looking at it as Shakespeare echoing his message about free will, fate, and the sanctity of the state. When we examine the crimes of the three imaginary sinners, we see that they roughly correlate with Macbeth's own actions. The farmer's sin is self-seeking greed. The equivocator's crime is treason. The tailor's crime is theft of clothing that properly belongs to others. Again, remember here all the references to clothing in the play. Macbeth is guilty of all these sins also, and in each of these cases, the sinner's own actions led to their deaths. It is only logical that Macbeth's actions will also lead to his death. On a final note, there is something hopeful in the porter's speech. It doesn't appear so from the outset, but in all his descriptions of his battle with alcohol, where he describes a physical fight being too strong for him, though he took up my legs sometimes, this battle of an individual man against alcohol is won, ultimately, by the man when he vomits the alcohol up. "I made a shift to cast him." Similarly, the evil in the state of Scotland would also be purged or removed, the killing of Macbeth. The porter, in many ways, is a representative of ordinary people, and he is looking to the future.
And lastly, Peter's going to be talking about the character of Macduff.
I'm going to give you some ideas that you can use in your essays if you're writing about Macduff, so that you can show critical literacy and a really sophisticated understanding of the play. One way of understanding the character of Macduff is, similarly to Banquo, as a foil for Macbeth. If we consider that Macbeth turns his back through selfish greed on the established system and traditions of his country by killing the king and claiming the crown for himself, then Macduff does the complete opposite. He sacrifices everything he has, his wife, his children, his castle, to restore the rightful heir to the throne and restore balance and equilibrium in his country. Through Macduff, the audience sees the correct choices and actions that should be taken by a good subject. If we recall that Shakespeare was a supporter of royal power and the existing system, it's clear then that Macduff, who is the most outspoken in terms of his desire for revenge, is to be seen as a sort of hero himself. He sacrifices his family not to become king himself, but simply to restore the correct authority in his country. He is a pure traditionalist and as close to the perfect nobleman as you could get. When Macduff travels to England in Act 4, Scene 3 to meet with Malcolm to get his support to remove Macbeth from the throne, he reveals his deep concern about his country and the way it's going. Speaking to Malcolm, he says, "Bleed, bleed, poor country." And later he says, "Oh, Scotland, Scotland." It's clear that Macduff's loyalties lie with his nation, just as Macbeth's seemed to at the beginning of the play, before selfish ambition took over. Macduff, too, isn't willing to sacrifice his country simply to give Malcolm the throne either. When Malcolm, in an effort to test Macduff, lists all of his vices, Macduff is willing to overlook his desire for women and riches, but when Malcolm says that if he had power, he would pour the sweet milk of concord into hell and confound all unity on earth, Macduff says, not only is Malcolm not fit to govern, he's not fit to live. In this scene, then, Shakespeare presents the audience with the ideal version of the royal subject. He is willing to sacrifice all that he has to maintain the system, but ultimately, loyalty to his nation is his number one priority. Macduff's dedication and commitment to his country and his real king makes Macbeth's disregard of it stand out all the more. When Macbeth and Lady Macbeth carry out their deeds, they repeatedly call on heaven to look away or for light to be put out so they can't be seen. It's an acknowledgement that what they are doing is wrong. There can be few things worse than regicide, the killing of a king. When Macduff is informed in Act 4, Scene 3 that his family have been slaughtered by the tyrant, he swears revenge. Interestingly, he invokes heaven as well, and he brings the idea of God and heaven into his quest. He says, "Gentle heavens, cut short all intermission. Front to front bring thou this fiend of Scotland and myself. Within my sword's length set him. If he scape, heaven forgive him too." Here Macduff is secure in the knowledge that his desire for revenge is righteous. He asks gentle heaven to bring Macbeth before his sword so he can deal with him. Malcolm too invokes heaven when he responds to Macduff, telling him Macbeth is ripe for the shaking, and the powers above put on their instruments. The suggestion here is that they are righteous and that theirs is somehow a holy war against the tyrant Macbeth. Macduff and Malcolm are on the side of God and heaven. All of this confirms the idea that Macduff is an idealised version of the royal subject, deployed or used to expose and highlight Macbeth's worst traits and excesses. It's no coincidence then, at the end of the play, that it is Macduff who kills Macbeth. If Macduff is the perfect subject and Macbeth is to be viewed as an example of selfish ambition, then Shakespeare makes a very obvious claim for tradition and upholding the system through the last interaction between these two characters in Act 5, Scene 8. Macbeth at first is reluctant to fight Macduff because he feels that his soul is too much charged with Macduff family blood, a reference to the slaughter of Macduff's family earlier. But Macduff, following the lead of Lady Macbeth, calls him a coward in order to bait him into doing something he said he didn't want to. And it works. Macbeth, in his last few lines, says, "I will not yield to kiss the ground before young Malcolm's feet." As a good subject, he should be more than willing to kiss the ground before the king's feet. Macduff re-enters in the next scene, carrying Macbeth's head, and announces that now the time is free, and hails Malcolm as King of Scotland. Shakespeare does something quite interesting here. The fact is that despite Macbeth's actions, he's still king. He was still crowned king at Scone. And as such, Macduff has committed regicide, the same crime that Macbeth did. But the audience and Macduff himself are protected from this by Macbeth's extreme actions in murdering Macduff's entire family. It is clear then that Macbeth and Macduff are broadly similar characters. They are both noble lords, they both have outspoken wives, and they both take fate into their own hands. Macbeth to claim the crown and Macduff travelling to England to restore the rightful heir. Macbeth's actions are all prompted by selfishness and greed and personal ambition, whereas Macduff's actions are prompted by his love for his country and the rightful king. Macduff then shows up Macbeth to be lacking in loyalty and traditional values.
That concludes Peter's analysis on Banquo the Porter and Macduff. We hope this has helped you gain a deeper understanding of their characters and equipped you with ideas and phrases that you can use in your essays. Once again, if you enjoyed this episode and you found it helpful, we would really encourage you to check out Peter's YouTube channel, Mr. Tobin Leaving Cert English, which is linked in this episode's description. Trust us when we say this is an incredible free resource for 5th and 6th year students. And we hope you stay tuned for more content like this.